Whether it's a book or a movie, many of us like our stories to wrap up, you know, to actually come to a nice conclusion, a nice resolution to the story. We want those major storylines to reach a satisfying end. And sometimes authors try to do that, writers try to do that, and, it's not satisfying to us. You know, take, for example, the ending of the TV series Lost. Yeah, that's right. How many of us regret spending our time watching that series when we got to the season finale? Now, I guess the writers just wanted to find resolutions for the individual characters. I would like resolution to the actual story. What was happening on that island? We deserve to know. Man, some people. And then there's the ending to the show Newhart. You're familiar with that one. You know, Bob Newhart plays this character, Dick Loudon, who's an innkeeper in a Vermont town full of eccentric people, you know, like Larry, his brother Daryl, and his other brother Daryl. Good people. Well, the very last show, of that series, Bob Newhart's character wakes up in bed next to his wife, only it's not the right wife. He actually had an earlier sitcom called The Bob Newhart Show. And he wakes up, not as Dick Loudon, but as Dr. Robert Hartley. From the first sitcom that he was in, he wakes up and tells his wife about this strange dream he had about being an innkeeper in Vermont. So the whole series, I guess, was a dream from the other series. I guess it wraps it up, though. So, and you don't want to get me started about one of those Christopher Nolan movies that I'm not going to ruin for everybody, but it involves a spinning top at the end, and I still want to know whether that top stops spinning or not. It matters, even if it doesn't matter to the main character. It matters to me. I like resolutions, especially good ones, you know, good endings, where the character, the main character, achieved his or her goal. When justice was served, when there's a peaceful final resolution, you know, you might say, well, Kurt, that's not real life. And that's true. I mean, the real world, it's full of ambiguity. You know, there's often not resolution in our story. Bad things happen. Justice isn't served. Things don't wrap up like the Brady Bunch. And we'd like it to, but it doesn't. But wouldn't you like to know that in the end, it actually is going to wrap up? See, our story's not over. Wouldn't you like to know that in the end, there really is a peaceful resolution to your life, that you actually do accomplish the purpose of your life? If you want to know that, you're in luck this morning. God tells us about the resolution to his story here at the end of this section of Isaiah. He tells us about the end before it happens. Now, why would he do that? Well, Kevin Van Hooser, he compares life to a play. He's a theologian. And so he basically says, you know, we're the actors, and the Bible helps us understand our role in this story. Now, he's not saying that we should just play act, that we should just pretend what we're doing. He's saying that there is a story. We're in this story that God's writing. And as we understand the story, as the Word tells us what that story is about, we understand what we're supposed to be doing here. So, the end of the story tells us where we're headed. It clarifies what we're supposed to be doing in the present. That's what this final section of the section we're in Isaiah is doing in chapter 27. It tells us how the end of our story wraps up so that we understand how we're supposed to head towards that end. So far from causing us to not worry about the present, the future actually focuses us on the present. Helps us understand what's worth it in the end. What doesn't last, what won't matter here in the present. So what we want to do is we want to take a good look at this final scene. And by catching a glimpse of that day, it's going to help us know what we're supposed to be doing today. So as Isaiah gives this resolution to our story, he uses that terminology, that day. You see it repeated throughout this section. So it's seen twice at the beginning and twice at the end. And there's four different ways in this passage that our story is resolved in that day. In that day, Satan will be defeated. In that day, Israel will be a fruitful vineyard. In that day, the world will be separated. And in that day, the world will be gathered for worship. So in the end, Satan will be defeated. Israel will be a fruitful vineyard. The world will be separated and gathered for worship. So let's look at the first way our story is resolved. In Isaiah 27, you get this behind-the-scenes look here in the first verse. Many of us want to know that, right? We want to know who's behind it all. You know, who's behind all the chaos, all the nefarious stuff happening, the mysterious they and them, right? We want to know who's really behind all the chicanery and skullduggery and any other good word you can think of for secret stuff going on. We want that person or that thing or those beings to be brought to light, and we want there to be justice in the end. Now, in the Old Testament, it wasn't always clear who that being or those beings were. But there's these various instances in the Bible where this mysterious, you can see this mysterious evil at work. Saw it first in the Garden of Eden, the serpent. This mysterious creature that it says was more crafty than any other beast of the field. It's clearly not just any old snake. Now, while the nations around Israel, they didn't share Israel's theology, they did share this belief that there really was something out there that was opposed to the order that they saw in the world. You know, this dragon-like creature in the pagan stories that usually was connected with the sea and the gods had to defeat at some point. So gradually, God begins to reveal a little bit more about this unseen chief enemy of his. Eventually, he's referred to in Job as the Satan. Satan being actually a Hebrew word that means enemy, but it can also be used in a courtroom scene for the prosecuting attorney, and that's kind of how he's seen in Zechariah. But there he's still the Satan. Only place in the Old Testament that actually uses the name, that word as a name, is in 2 Chronicles. So then you get to the New Testament, more is said about Satan. And that's who this is about. Here in Isaiah, this is talking about Satan. So in that day, Satan will be defeated. That's what verse 1 says. Here's what it says. In that day, the Lord, this hard and great and strong sword, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is in the sea. So in the Old Testament, that word Leviathan gets applied to different things, as was this term Tanin, which is translated dragon here. So at the end of Job, Leviathan seems like it's an actual creature that God had made. And it's also true of the Tanin in Genesis 1:21. It's this creature that God had made. Great sea creature. But those words can also be used figuratively for this enemy of God, this chaotic enemy of God that has to be overcome. So the same thing that you find again in those pagan myths. The Babylonian creation story has the chief god Marduk have to defeat this sea monster named Tiamat, and similar stories in the Hittites, among the Hittites. But then even closer to home for Israel, they've discovered this Canaanite tale of a sea monster named Lotan. What's interesting is that Lotan, if you look at the wording in the original languages, is very, very similar to Leviathan. Now, it doesn't mean that the Bible is borrowing. This is the thing that some people do. The Bible's borrowing from pagan myths. No, but it is talking about the same thing. This very chaotic and evil entity that opposes the order that God's established. So Isaiah doesn't at all believe the idolatrous view of that the pagans had for the world. He believes the revelation that God has given, which actually demythologized the world. The Lord is the one who's enthroned over creation. So all these so-called gods are just demons that are trying to present themselves like they're God. But then there was still this arch enemy of God, mysterious entity. And that's what Isaiah is describing here. Now, what's very interesting is the way that Canaanite story describes that creature. So in one of the poems, it says, "When you smite Lotan, the fleeing serpent, put an end to the torturous serpent, Shaliat of the seven heads." You have Lotan, described just like Leviathan is here. There's three different ways it's described, and it's also described as a serpent. And guess what? John describes the same being as having seven heads in Revelation 12:3. These are all talking about the same reality, even if the pagans didn't understand it as God would reveal it. And the term Tanin, again, it can be described in this dragon-like creature. But in Exodus 7, it's used to describe the serpent that is transformed from Aaron's rod. So again, you have this connection between these, the serpent, the dragon, Lotan, Leviathan. This word is translated here, dragon. It's the same word found in Revelation 12. So you have this overlap. And the word for serpent is the same word for serpent from Genesis 3 in the garden. So what you have is this collection of all these ideas, and John pulls it all together in Revelation 12. He has the seven-headed dragon. That's also the ancient serpent from Genesis 3. He calls him the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. So John's pulling it all together. Isaiah's talking about the same entity. This is the archenemy of God who deceives the world. He's in the garden. The very beginning, he was the father of lies, and he's been behind it all ever since. Now, this is not teaching us that a kind of yin-yang situation where there's good and evil always existing. That is not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches very clearly that Satan is a creature. So we may not understand all that went into where he came from, but he's not eternal. He's not independent or infinite. He's not omniscient, omnipotent, or omnipresent. He is a powerful being, though. He is the prince of the power of the air, as Paul puts it in Ephesians 2:2. He's like the Pied Piper who's leading the world along this course that they're taking. And so the Lord wants us to know that all this subterfuge, all this devious schemes that he's working out, there is an expiration date for that. In the end, in that day, the Lord is going to slay Satan with his hard and great and strong sword. It's a hard sword. It's capable of piercing the dragon's scales. It's not going to relent in judgment. It's great enough to match the greatness of this Leviathan. It's strong enough to overcome him. But the reality is we should never think that we're strong enough to destroy Satan with our strength. We have the constitution to defeat Satan. That is not what this is stressing. Ken's mentioned a number of times that individual who came here and challenged Satan from the pulpit, and it didn't turn out well for him, did it? Yep. That's dumb. I mean, if Michael the archangel is not going to presume to pronounce judgment on Satan in Jude 9, I'm pretty sure we mortals shouldn't be messing around either. So what this is doing is it's putting the enemy into perspective. It's saying that even this powerful arch enemy of God is going to have his final day. He's going to be defeated. So we should not put Satan on the level of God. As powerful and as scary sometimes as we think he is, he has a judgment day. And we are connected to the one who is greater, so much greater than that creature. So that's the first resolution. Satan will be defeated. The second way that our stories revolved has to do with Israel. So verse 2 through 6 tells us that in that day, Israel will be a fruitful vineyard. If you want to understand what Isaiah is talking about here, you have to go back and remember what he said in chapter 5. So here's the song about a vineyard in chapter 5 of Isaiah. You can look there. You can turn back and look there. It says, "Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I had not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste, It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. Thou also command the clouds that the rain, that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold, an outcry. So there's this sad tale of a vineyard that God planted. He gave it every opportunity to accomplish exactly what it was supposed to accomplish. It was supposed to produce grapes to make wine. It failed. So for that reason, God promised to remove all his protection from it so that it would be destroyed. This is the reprise, though. This is that same kind of tune, but we're seeing another side to it. So in verse 2 of Isaiah 27, it says, "In that day, a pleasant vineyard, sing of it." So the ESV translates one word from different manuscripts that are found for this passage that is translated pleasant. But there are other manuscripts with a different word, and the only difference between these two words is one little stroke. So the last letter is only different by slightly longer stroke from one of the letters. So either of them fit, but it seems like what the King James Version and the NASB have is, I think, the correct wording. So I think it should read, a vineyard of wine. So unlike in chapter 5, where the vineyard didn't produce grapes for wine, here you have a vineyard that does what it's supposed to do. It produces wine. And then you remember how the Lord built that watchtower and hedge, and then he removed those protections. Well, here he's emphatically stating from the start, saying, I, the Lord, he's the keeper of this vineyard. He's stationed so he can protect it, keep watch over it, lest anyone would come and bring harm to it. And then he repeats that root for keeper, and he says that he keeps watch over it night and day. And before, again, he said he was commanding the clouds not to rain on the vineyard. Well, here he says he waters the vineyard every moment. So there's perpetual care every moment and night and day. Now, you could hear God's anger back in chapter 5. He was angry over what that vineyard was doing. But here he says, I have no wrath. His wrath has been propitiated, as theologians put it. The bloodshed and the outcry that rightly angered God have been properly dealt with. So he's no longer righteously angry with his people. And those briars and thorns would grow that grew in the vineyard in chapter 5, they're no longer there. Nowhere to be found. Instead, what the Lord says is, would that I had thorns and briars to battle. I would march against them. I would burn them up together. This is one of those places where the Lord comes. He describes himself really as a husband and his people as his wife. And he's basically saying he would love it if somebody would even try something with his wife. You ever had that feeling before? I've had that feeling before. You know, feel like maybe you would love to show your bride that you could defend her. You would love to show that. That's how much you care about her. Now, I was a buck 45 when I was younger. Probably should not have presumed on God. So I'm glad nothing happened like that. I weigh a little bit more now, but I'm not in shape now. So, I mean, there's a reality which it's a little idealistic for me to say something like this. But God can actually do it. He can actually take care of his bride. And that's what he promises to do here. And think about the transformation between chapter 5 and this chapter. I mean, he was clearly angry with Israel. He looked for justice, and behold, bloodshed, for righteousness, and behold, outcry. And everything's changed now in chapter 27. Israel's doing what they're supposed to do, what they were made for. So we can put two and two together and say what they were made for then is justice and righteousness, which is really just a way for the prophets to talk about society as rightly ordered, the way society is supposed to work. Israel's been purified. The satanic chaos, it's been removed. So now Israel exists in perfect communion with her husband. Those thorns and briars, those outsiders that do not belong to God, they're gone. They're excluded. But look at verse 5. The ESV has a fairly literal translation. It says, or let them lay hold of my protection. That wording, though, in Hebrew, it means more than just an alternative. It has to do with the result of that alternative. So you could translate it unless, like the NET and the NLT do. So verse 5 is saying that God will march against and burn up those thorns and briars unless they lay hold of his protection. Protection there, it could be translated stronghold as it is elsewhere in Isaiah. It's synonymous with that idea of refuge, finding protection. So this is very much like the promise in Psalm 2, where God says at the very end of it that everyone who takes refuge in the Son is considered blessed. That's what the Lord wants. So just as much as he wants us to do what's right, to love the way that he loves, he wants those who have rebelled against his love and righteousness, who deserve his punishment, he wants them to turn back to him. So instead of running from his punishing anger, we're supposed to seek protection from that punishment, from him. That's the wild thing about the Bible. It does not shy away from the anger, the righteous anger God has for our sin. But it is very clear that when we learn about that anger, what we should do is run to that God. Because he's not only angry, he is loving and patient and gracious and merciful. And he wants us to go to him to protect us from the punishment that we deserve, that he has to carry out as a righteous judge. So the Lord stresses that desire. He repeats himself in the second and third lines of verse 5. He says, let them make peace with me. Let them make peace with me. Making peace with someone, it's also referred to as reconciling, right? You reconcile. The New Testament is very clear about how we're reconciled to God. We're reconciled through Jesus. Specifically in Romans 5:10, it talks about being reconciled through Jesus' death. Now, how does that work? Well, again, like I said, in order for God to be truly righteous, he has to punish our sin. Our sin requires restitution. You could think about it this way. Our sin causes damages that have to be paid for. It's not loving to the people who've experienced those damages for them not to be paid for. So God has to pay for those damages. But here is the amazing, gracious thing, is that Jesus came and paid for those damages for everyone who would trust in him. So what the Lord's doing is he's encouraging his enemies to be reconciled to him. So don't ignore him. Listen to God. Look to Jesus. Believe that he died to pay your punishment. Stop rebelling. Come back to God. He'll take you back. Make peace with him by turning from your sin, trusting in Jesus' rescue, and then start listening to him. Isaiah ends this second part by promising that this fruitful vine is not going to be confined to Israel. So verse 6 says, in days to come, Jacob shall take root, Israel shall blossom and put forth shoots, and will fill the whole world with fruit. So once again, you see that God's Old Testament plans were not only for Israel. Israel is the instrument that God would use to fill the earth with the knowledge of him. As the waters cover the sea, that's how Isaiah puts it in chapter 11. Israel, Jacob, refer to the same people of God, the old covenant people of God. It says they will take root and blossom and send out shoots, spread out and fill the whole world with its fruit, as a vine would do. The whole earth is then, based on, pull the analogies together in chapter 5 and 27, the whole earth is then full of justice and righteousness. That's the effect of knowing the Lord. The entire world is going to be full of image bearers who actually do what we were made to do. We reflect God's righteousness, God's justice. We reflect the order that God created the world for. So in the end, we are going to actually accomplish our purpose, the purpose of our existence. But you know what? We don't have to wait till the end. See, everyone who knows God, everyone who's taken refuge in his Son, we can start to reflect his holiness and righteousness now. That's why he gave us the Holy Spirit, that we would be created even now into the image of the Son. So when you look to where your story's headed, you can begin to treat others the way that God desires us to. That's what we should do. Why would we do otherwise? It doesn't matter if other people aren't doing that. We're just ahead of our time. In the end, everybody's going to see that the purpose we're living for was the right purpose. May not look that way now. People may not agree. But the end is going to reveal it. The whole world is one day going to see that our integrity was worth it, that our commitment to unborn life was right, that our refusal to encourage or take part in immorality wasn't behind the times, it was ahead of them. So we can keep going now in the middle of the story because we know what the end is going to be like. But that's not the end of the story for everyone. And Isaiah shows that with the third glimpse at our resolution. In that day, the world will be separated. In Johnny Cash's apocalyptic song, When the Man Comes to Town, or When the Man Comes Around, he starts by saying, there's a man going around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. That's a harsh reality. But it's true. Everybody won't be treated all the same. And you might say, well, that's not fair. But we have to put that in perspective, right? Because what is fair, or what is not fair, rather, is not to be punished. What is fair, as the Bible describes it, is that we would all be punished. We've all rejected God. We've all gone away from him. What's fair is that we are condemned, and we have to pay for what we've done. So, while Isaiah writes this, it's evident, the reason why he makes this transition here, it's evident that the enemies of God have not been judged. Israel has been struck by God's enemies. They've been slain by them. So God's already begun keeping his promise from chapter 5 about that vineyard. And there's more to come. And so Israel faces this discipline from God as they waited for the final day, but they needed to keep that in perspective. They needed to see the difference between what God was doing with them and what God was going to do with his enemies one day. So what God accomplished with his people was different than the punishment he was going to carry out, again, on the enemies who were then punishing Israel. So God had two different purposes, two different goals with these two groups. One was a purifying goal. The other was punitive. One was corrective. The other was retributive. So in verse 7, he compares this treatment. And he says, has he struck them as he struck those who struck them? Or have they been slain as their slayers were slain? You can see how Isaiah, again, he loves that repetition. It's kind of sounds a little bit like Dr. Seuss. I mean, he likes to have these repeated sounds, repeated words. But the overall point is that God is, he strikes his enemies differently than those enemies had struck his own people. The nature of their deaths is different. We saw that back in the last chapter in verse 19. There's a difference. Well, verse 19 and verse 14. So verse 8 then goes on to talk about the experience of God's people. And I again think the NASB is closer to the meaning. It doesn't put it in the right order, and it doesn't translate it literally, but it's closer to the original. The first phrase, I think, could be described as God shooing Israel away, like somebody would do with goats or donkeys. You have to shoo them. It's parallel to the second line that talks about God sending Israel away. That wording, and both of these, I should say, shooing and sending, both have this or could be interpreted as having these feminine pronouns. So shooing her, sending her away. The problem is that the last person we've talked about is Jacob and Israel. They're masculine. So what Isaiah is doing is he's switched the picture here, and he's now describing divorce. It's what the Old Testament describes for divorce, sending someone away, and using the second word for contend with. Shouldn't say them. The Hebrew actually has a her again. So we could read it as, by shooing her, by sending her, divorcing her, you carry out divorce proceedings with her. So the image, it is probably seems to be talking about exile, but it's giving that, it's portraying that as a divorce, that God is divorcing Israel, sending them away. The same word he used to describe his sword in verse 1, he describes his breath here, or the wind, this hard breath, this severe wind that he's sent out. And he describes it as the day of the east wind. That was also known as the Sirocco. This is this really hot wind that goes blowing over the desert. And what it would do is it would ruin crops. But the thing about that wind is it didn't continue forever. It came, it was destructive, but then it was gone. So there is a temporary discipline that's happening here. And then Isaiah explains that through that discipline, Israel's sin, Jacob's sin, was going to be punished and taken care of. So their guilt would be paid for and removed from them through that exile, through that punishment. Now, that is not saying, well, this is how spiritual atonement happens. This is how people's sins are paid for. We experience that in this life. You have to realize that, again, Israel is a means of revelation. It's through them that the world is going to one day know the Lord. And so, just like they displayed God's ultimate salvation in Exodus by picturing what redemption looks like, they did the same thing with atonement through exile. It illustrates a greater salvation. So their exile illustrates the way that their sin is removed. Christ fulfills both the Exodus and the exile. He fulfills what redemption really is all about and what atonement's really about. So Jesus actually suffered the most ultimate form of exile. He wasn't just banished from a land. He was banished from the land of the living. And then he returned. And that helps us understand how our sin is dealt with, how it's paid for. So Isaiah then describes the effects of that atonement, the effects of removing sin. He says that there's a fruit that came with it. The full fruit, the complete result of removing sin, is the obliteration of idolatry. So when God would take away Israel's sin through Jesus, their idolatrous hearts would be conquered. Never again would they be disloyal to God. Those altars that were built to false gods, they'd be crushed to pieces like chalk stones. There wouldn't be any Asherah poles or incense altars left standing. So no sin would remain in that final day. So for God's people, that meant the removal of their sin in their heart. But for the enemies of God who refused to repent, they would have to be removed themselves. That's what verses 10 and 11 describe. You have this city of the nations, the world city, that's united against God that we've seen repeated throughout these chapters. That city was going to be completely empty. It's going to be a habitation deserted and forsaken. It's like the wilderness where there's just enough vegetation for animals to pass through, but they can't stick around because they'll eat it all away. So you have even just a little calf that can go up to a tree and just eat it bare. Just a calf. And then what that tree is good for is just firewood. Dries out. Dead. And that's what it describes here. So here this city, those who are opposed to God, that's what they're like. They're like something that's only good for these women to come along and break off limbs and use for their firewood. So why is there this difference in God's treatment? Well, verse 11 explains. They are a people without discernment. It's a term you could find in Proverbs. It means they lack wisdom. They lack the ability to live in the ordered way that God designed for the world. So they said, God, we don't need you. We don't need you to tell us how to live. We can do that on our own. And when the man comes around, he's going to establish God's order. So for those who've had their sin removed from them, they can fit with that order. But those who haven't cannot fit with that order, and so they must be removed. That's what this is describing. And then you hear this truly horrifying reality. Verse 11 ends with, therefore, he who made them will not have compassion on them. He who formed them will show them no favor. You know, people often view God, as someone once put it, you know, God will forgive. That's his job. The idea is that God's always just going to forgive. It doesn't matter. I'm always going to be able to just say, oh, sorry, God. If I come up in front of him someday, I'll just be able to say I'm sorry and it'll be fine with him. True, God is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, but he's not always going to be patient. There is an end to that patience. There is a time when there is no more mercy, when there's no more favor, or we could translate that grace. Mercy and grace are not owed to us. We don't deserve that kindness that God's shown us. He gives us time here on earth, more time. As Paul puts it, that kindness, that patient kindness, was supposed to intend, God intended that to lead us to repentance. So we deserve punishment. God made us. He formed us. That's the way it's described here. He designed us and sustains us. So he has the right to evaluate whether or not we do what we were made to do. And when we stand before Christ one day, the one who the New Testament says is through whom all things were made, we stand before that Christ, those who did not turn to him in this life, they will not have a second chance. It'll be too late. In the end, there is no more compassion or grace. So now is the time to hear this and respond to it. To hear this and realize what God has done. And to believe that he's rescued you from that punishment. And to look to him. Because if you wait and you look to him on judgment day, there'll be no place to hide. So hide in him now. Look to him for protection now. Now, for those who have experienced God's grace here in the middle of the story, we can look forward to this final resolution. Our story is resolved when Satan is defeated, when Israel is a fruitful vineyard, when the world is separated. And then finally, in these last two verses, in that day, the world will be gathered for worship. Alec Motier, always forget that he's French. Somebody corrected me once. Alec Motier, he has this great explanation of how this section is patterned. It's called a chiasm. So you have verse 1 and verse 13. You have this great sword in verse 1 and a great trumpet in verse 13. And then in the vineyard section, verses 2 through 6, that gets matched with this harvest that's mentioned in verse 12. And then you have this middle section, 7 through 11. And then he shows how this closing part of this section, this Oracles of the Nation, how it's actually connected to the very beginning. Chapter 14, verse 21, and then chapter 27 here in verse 6. So in the middle of that, in the middle of this section, we have what God says about Assyria and Egypt, which are mentioned here. So Isaiah 19, 23 through 25 says in very, very similar language, in that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. And Assyria will come into Egypt and Egypt into Assyria. And the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. You have the same timing. In that day. And then you have the same three mentioned here in this last section. Verse 12 mentions the river. It's translated the Euphrates, but it says the river. And it has the brook of Egypt. And both of those, they're significant for a couple reasons. One, these are the boundaries of the promised land, according to places like Genesis 15, 18. The boundaries was from the river, Euphrates, to this brook of Egypt. But that's also the starting points, starting and ending points for this highway. From the border with Assyria to the border with Egypt, according to Isaiah 19. Now here, in that first verse, it promises that God is going to harvest his remnant. So back in chapter 24, Israel was compared to what it would be like after the olive harvest, you know, when there wasn't much left. It was all said and done, and everything had been picked through. There was just a remnant. And he picks up that same imagery here. Doesn't actually mention grain, and the word for thresh isn't the normal word for thresh. So it seems like he's coming back to that and talking about knocking these last berries down from the tree and collecting them, gleaning, as he puts it. So the Lord is going to very carefully collect one by one his people from the border with Assyria to the border with Egypt. And then verse 13 describes that collection in a second way. It says, in that day, a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were lost in the land of Assyria and those who were driven out of the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain of Jerusalem. It's a prophecy that Jesus picks up in Matthew 24, 31 to describe that trumpet call to his elect, gather them from the four corners of the earth. It's picked up by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, 52 and 1 Thessalonians 4, 16, the last trumpet. So the Lord, through Isaiah, he's connecting, it seems like, this last trumpet, this trumpet blowing, with the year of Jubilee. It's where you see the trumpet. Leviticus 25, 8 and 9, it tells Israel that they're to blow a trumpet on the Day of Atonement. That was the Day of Atonement after the 49th year, the seventh sabbatical year. So on the 50th year, they blow this trumpet on the Day of Atonement, and that's when all these property rights would get restored. And where if you had sold yourself to indentured service, it would come to an end. And basically, it was this big reset. And it was all actually a picture pointing to the actual reset, the final reset, when everything was set to right. So Isaiah picks up on that. It says, those that were lost in Assyria or driven to Egypt would come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem. So you see this imagery, and again, there is this imagery of exile, and there's a return from exile, but the reality again is that Judah was an exile to Assyria or Egypt. This is Isaiah explaining through the most powerful forces in his day what God is going to do in the end. And again, we have just conveniently this highway from the same entities, with not only the people of Israel joining on that highway to worship, but also the people from Assyria and Egypt themselves now being joined with Israel and worshiping the Lord, just as Isaiah promised in chapter 2, in Jerusalem. We could say brought back to worship in the new Jerusalem. Now, that word lost, we could translate it perishing. It's a word translated by a Greek word that John uses in John 3:16. Same word. God talks about loving the world. He sent his son so that those who believe in him would not perish, would not be lost. Those who are lost are saved. Those who believe in Jesus are not perishing anymore. And then humanity was driven out of the garden, just as Israel would be driven out of the promised land. But in the end, some from every nation is going to be brought back to God for worship. So that's our story. In the end, we do end up doing what we were made for. We're made to worship God. In the end, that's what we do. We worship the Lord. So there and back again is not just a hobbit tale. It's also our tale. There and back again. There's a complete resolution to the story. Nothing's left hanging. There's not any confusion over that storyline. What God was doing is revealed and completed. And so now that you know the end of the story, live in light of it. So in that day, Satan is defeated. Israel is a fruitful vineyard. And the world is separated and gathered for worship. Live in view of that. Join me in prayer. Father, thank you for sharing with us the end of the story. For not keeping us in suspense. For being clear with us. For telling us the way it's going to end. And you who created everything from nothing, you who is sovereign over everything in this universe, who sustain you sustain our very lives. There's no way for this not to reach the end for which you planned. You are in charge. And this is the end of the story that you're writing that then leads to a wonderful eternal epilogue, as it were, where we enjoy that final resolution for all eternity. So thank you for telling us about that so that we could live in light of it now, so we cannot be confused by what the people around us tell us and think that we're supposed to live by their storyline. But you've told us the way that reality really is. So we ask for your strength to live in light of this story in spite of the many, many, many people around us who do not do that. And we pray also for anyone here who is not living in light of this story. You have been very gracious to them, bringing them here in this moment to hear this truth now before the end. We pray that this truth really would be transforming. They would hear it. They would believe it. They would live in light of it. You know, it's only by your grace. Amen.